welcome to episode 19 of the First 7-Inch Club. This is the podcast where you listen to a bunch of old music by bands that may not be on the tip of your tongue that broke up after a handful of years together and a handful of releases. And we asked the question, are they worth listening to? Should we remember these guys? Should I buy this shitty record? We're answering all the questions of all these old forgotten bands. I am Mike, and with me is Scott.
Mike, do you think you can remember, and I'm not talking about like a read and listen or any of that shit. Can you remember the first musical 7-inch you've owned in this life? Any kind of music, a 7-inch record, a 45 of any flavor. What's the first one that you think you owned that was musical?
I remember the first 7-inch I owned. I don't think I had 45s as a kid, so I'm going to have to go with that first 7-inch. I think I know what it is.
I know what mine is. We had records all over the house. The place was littered because my aunts were slobs and my grandparents' basement was just littered with records, and we'd play them. We'd pick one up off the floor that we'd been like breakdancing on or whatever and put it on, and it would be like a disco record. Those records everywhere. But the first one I bought with money, my grandmother took me out to the grocery store. You can get records at the grocery store. And I bought the E.T. soundtrack, the E.T. music. And we brought it back and I have one cousin who's a little older than me and one cousin who's a little younger. And we were sitting around there and I put it on and started playing it with my grandmother. And I turned to everybody and I just felt it in my heart. And I was like, even just listening to this music makes me want to cry. And I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but my grandmother, who was like the most enabling and supportive person, both good and bad, would always be there for you. She looked at me like I had just walked into the yard and picked up a dog shit and like handed it to her. She was just so perplexed. And my cousins gave me nothing. They both looked at me like I was an idiot. And I'm like, all right, I'll go back. I'll go back to like it was before. I won't talk about this again.
So the whole soundtrack was on a 45.
It was just like the theme song, and then the other side might have been like a story.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And it stirred me up.
I remember buying a record from the grocery store, but it wasn't a 7-inch. It was a full LP. Yeah. It was by this rapper named Jazz, who was Jay-Z was like his hype man back then because it was so long ago. But he sang a song called Hawaiian Sophie. That was his one semi pseudo hit. And it features a young Jay-Z on the record. But I bought it because like, I don't know, I think it was cheap. And I asked my mom and she bought it for me. So,
yeah, man, there was like we had this thing called the Manans Tri-City Market. I don't even remember exactly what it was, but it was basically just this like lightning flea market. Like they took over this thing the size of like a BJ's warehouse or something and would just set up boxes. And it was real product, but I guess it just fell off of trucks or something like that. Some, like mob run operation. And we went in there once with one of my like babysitters or something, and they had like a tent set up with a bunch of records, and they were selling the Quiet Riot Mental Health record. And that was hot at the time. And I was like, I wanted it so bad. And I was looking at it, but I was like, I didn't feel worthy of buying a metal record. So I got real, real bent out of shape. And I was like, should I get it? I mean, I'm like a child, like a baby or something. And the lady who was with me was like, what is your fucking problem? Buy it. It's just a record. And I was like, what if the cool kids ask me about it? And I don't know anything about Quiet Riot or something. So I didn't get it that night. I had to wait. I waited a couple more weeks. But yeah, they used to sell records at the weirdest places. There would just be like a record drop and you would just buy, I mean, those records on cereal boxes and all kinds of stuff like that too. But you could buy like Hall & Oates 7-inches at drugstores and stuff back then.
Do you remember when you used to be able to, I mean, this was even more recent than records, was when you could rent videos from the grocery store?
Oh yeah. Yeah. All of my first video rentals were from Record Town. when all of the, you know, people, I don't know how far FYE extends, the trans world. I don't know how that far they extend. I know they've taken over most of the country at some point, but Record Town, Strawberries and Tape World were all basically one company, and Record Town was like the first cool place that rented videos around here. And I ran their horror section. I mean, I rented every Dead Pit, every like horrible 3D covered, like the bumpy covers and everything like that. I rented everything there. It was the weirdest place because you'd walk through a record store and in the back there'd be like a video rental section. And that's where my grandmother, that's where everyone went to rent all their movies. and the grocery stores in my college town sold them. They sold these movies and they were made for real. Like they were manufactured, but they were recorded like super SLP, like the worst speed. And you'd look at it and there'd be like 2 millimeters of tape inside the tape. They fit a whole movie on that. And I was like, oh, awesome. They had like Meatballs and Stripes and all these movies. And I just bought a bunch to have in my dorm and I brought them back and they're like, you can't fix the tracking to save your life.
Yeah, I remember those tapes. They used to put cartoons on those tapes a lot too.
Yeah. So we have another little topic to cover. Yeah. And I don't know how to, I feel like I got to tiptoe around even some of the words we're about to say.
We're gonna get canceled. This is episode 19, first 7-inch club getting canceled.
We found out through the Discord chat. This is the first I'd ever heard of this, and it seems like the first other people had heard of it. Apparently, yes. You know, once upon a time the Bridge 9 board was aware of this. But Dwid from Integrity, first of all, I want to say why we found out about this, because our friend Brian, who collects t-shirts, rightfully turned down a One Life Crew shirt.
Yeah,
that he found on a rack somewhere because it calls you a fruit on the back.
Yeah,
the shirt just calls you a fruit, and that's not like
it says welcome to the neighborhood, and then that fruit, it's from their first record. Yeah.
Oh, so all right, I've never I've worked hard.
You can pretend you're too woke to listen to One Life Crew, Scott. It's cool.
I've seen them live.
It's fine. I'll take the bullet. I'll take the bullet.
I've seen them live at least twice. That's the one where the singer wore the construction gloves, right? Or am I thinking of Pit Boss?
I mean, I'm sure they've all done it at one point, yeah.
Yeah, well, this guy wore extra super construction gloves. But, yeah, so they were talking about that, and I was like, you know, I was wondering out loud if Integrity had ever put out an offensive shirt. And so someone tells us, I don't know who he is in the chat, but he informed us that Dwid has a label named Negromancy, or Negromancy. Mm-hmm. Like necromancy, but...
I'm going to go it's the E with the line the above it, the hard E.
And you know I'm sure he's thinking he's getting by in this because it's basically like a black metal label, and you know Negro just means black in Spanish and a bunch of other languages. That's probably what he's thinking. You're not allowed to think that.
So just to give him credit, this was user Waterworld I think that's his Twitter name too. But just to back his story up, then like two other people were just like, yeah, like it's common knowledge. And I asked Doan, who you know he's from Cleveland originally, and he knows a lot of Integrity lore. And he was like, yeah, first I'm hearing of it. So this maybe evaded a lot of older folks, I guess, this Negromancy record label.
I mean, I know he does a lot of stuff.
I know what it is. I read the description, but I was like, I don't want to ruin what I the vision in my head of what this is, and I'm not even going to listen to it because if it's a lose-lose. If it was better or worse than what I was thinking in my head, it's a lose-lose, so I just didn't bother.
Well, if you go to their Bandcamp and you look at it, it basically looks like you've fallen through a portal to another world where vampires are real. It's all just like all the names of the albums or the bands or whatever I'm looking at here, it looks like vampire language. I don't know what country this is. I don't know if these are even words or if they're just, you know, like when chill wave bands used to name their bands with the crosses and stuff from the keyboard. But it's all like black and white, black metal looking covers and vampire words. And you can't figure any of it out. But what it is these are black metal albums or something like black metal adjacent music made with cigar box banjos. That's one of the rules is you have to build your own instruments out of trash and junk, and then you get to be on this label and you're doing black metal. And so, you know, I was thinking, well, it's going to be like Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas or something. Like it's going to be you know, it's going to be like that band Panopticon or something. He does kind of like bluegrass black metal or something. I thought maybe it'd be something like that, but no, they are trying to play black metal. It sounds sort of like black metal.
That's the most quizzical part of it is that we talk about records all the time on the show, and for the most part, it's all like, oh, yeah, this record label folded after 4 releases. There is, what is this? I think they're in the 30s. There's 34 releases on Negromancy Records. It's all weird vampire names. So I didn't do any research, but I'd have to assume, I bet a lot of these bands share the same members. But just to give them their due so we don't get canceled, the description of Negromancy, according to them, is Negromancy conjures lo-fi blackened lo-fi blackened Creole cigar box guitar spells and other acts of swamp witchery. Inspired by Robert Johnson selling his soul to the devil, Negromancy takes a left-hand turn at the crossroads and brings distorted occult music into a very different direction than ever before. And then it goes on to say that it's a cigar box guitar-based recording label, and they play homemade instruments, and they every release comes with the blueprints to construct your own guitar. And when I was doing some clicking around, because, you know, this is Discord, who knows who's a liar there? So I was trying to find, like, proof that Dwid, this is actually Dwid's label, and I think he's kind of, like, hiding under the rug because it's, you know, could be construed as racist, I guess. And like the only thing I found was they made a guitar for Fenriz, the famous black metal guy. And he's just like, and it has like the flag of Norway on the cigar box. And I just saw that picture and I was like, this is enough. I am done searching this topic. This is ridiculous.
This is something you do. This is a joke. This would be like your one Weird Al moment or whatever. Like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make an album like this. And then to have 30 something of these is like this joke needs. And they go up to when's the latest one? They go up to now? No, 2015. Maybe it's done.
It seemed to be really big between 2013 and 2015. I don't know what was in the water in those years when I don't know, but
I can't wait to say that. Remember in 2013 when everyone was making cigar box banjo metal?
I didn't have my finger on the pulse like it was like 2007 or anything, but 2013 I still kind of had my finger on the pulse. So
yeah.
So the fact that this just like was, I don't know. I mean, Scott is a lifelong Decibel magazine subscriber. Yeah. So if they mentioned it, he would have known about it. So it's definitely pretty underground.
Well, anyway.
Anyway. So I got a couple things because spoiler alert, the record we're talking about is two songs. It's about 5 or 6 minutes worth of music. So we're just kind of stalling. But just wanted to promote the Instagram. For 7-Inch Club on Instagram, I know I'm slacking. I've been busy the last couple of weeks. I haven't posted many flyers or really any. So I'm going to get back to that. I swear to God, I'm going to get back to it. I've just been busy. And it seems people like the flyers. So for 7-Inch Club on Instagram, also on YouTube if you want to listen to the records that we talk about. But all letters, too. For 7-Inch Club is all letters. No numbers in there. I also want to mention, I guess we just kind of did it, but I think Knocked Loose Chat was kind of a hit. I think a lot of people liked us talking about Knocked Loose and talking about new music. So I don't have any like concrete.
Yeah, I haven't listened to anything else.
That's the thing. I don't have any concrete plans, but I would like to filter in some kind of new band showcase into the beginning of the show, or at least some music chat, because it seems that, you know, there are people that listen to this probably are never going to pick up these 30-year-old records that we're talking about. So, So, I mean, if you guys have any suggestions, if you're in a band of, you know, like a stature, like I don't want to listen to your demo that no one's heard of yet. If you have some stature to your band, you know, you want us to roast it, I guess, like, I don't know. Or, you know, if you're just like, oh, you guys should check out like the new blah, blah, blah. Let us know. We're old. We know, like, you know, the bass level, big popular bands now, but even some of those. So if you're just like, hey, what do you guys think of this? Let us know, and we'll talk about it probably.
It works out sometimes. I mean, we're not unfair. I like people have thrown some stuff my way that I thought was going to be really dumb, and then I'm like, man, I'm going to play that again. I'm going to. I didn't think I liked this, but I like this. I'm going to keep listening.
Yeah, so I'm probably a lot more easygoing towards music now that I don't listen to hardcore a lot. So it's like when you hear a new band, it's not like I've listened to 50 other hardcore bands that week. So it's just kind of like, oh, this is pretty cool. So. Give us a shot. Let's hear your new music, your new recommendations, and we'll tell you how much it sucks.
Last episode had some good Instagram chat too, so let's do that again this episode. If you guys really have strong feelings on this band, come on.
I don't know if you're gonna, but so the band tonight is a band named Candle, and this is, I suppose, a self-titled record from 1994 on Wrenched Records. Out of Del Mar, California, and the band, I believe, is also out of Del Mar, California. Yes, they are. Candle was an emo band, an American emo hardcore band, according to their discogs from, I think, that's it. I think about 1994, they packed it in. they came out for this record and then split with Antioch Aero and called it a day, both on Wrenched Records. Wrenched Records is run by, I believe, the bassist of Candle. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. That's their history. One guy was also an Antioch Aero. Aaron Rickards. I want to say Grant is the guy who runs the label. Yeah. So he's friends with all these. So Aaron went on to just be an Antioch Arrow. So he just recorded that split by himself. And Brian and the other guy were both in, Brian and Grant were both in Second Story Window, who's much popular. And Spina Corzo, who you may remember from doing a split with Swing Kids, which is a band I actually like, because that's how I know him. I don't really know anything else about him. And then the other guy, Matt. So this leads down like a kind of like a Russian doll of bands that released this great, amazing memory for me, this memory that's been locked in my brain. And so Matt was in a band called Klickitat Ikatawi. I've never, again, it's another name I've never heard said out loud. And so that's how I've always said it. Are you familiar with this band, Scott?
Yeah.
So do you think I said it right?
I've always said it Klickitat Ikatawi, but I've never heard it. Okay. I don't have a reason to say it that way. I just do.
So Klickitat Ikatawi is a band I've heard of. I've never really thought much of them because, as we'll get into, I was not usually a huge fan of emo back then. But it's funny because on their Discogs, it says existing from 1994 into 1997 and from San Diego, Klickitat Ikatawi were an influential. So I assume they wrote this themselves because that's kind of a ballsy thing to write. We're an influential hardcore post-hardcore emo band featuring Mario Rubalcaba. I've never heard of this fucking guy. And so I'm just like, why the fuck would they write that? It's kind of like narcissistic to be like, yeah, this band was featuring this one guy that no one's ever heard of. But to his credit, he's been in a lot of bands. He's in Hot Snakes and Earthless, I think, are the biggest bands on this. Oh, Rocket from the Crypt is pretty big. I feel like we talked about Mannequin Piss last episode. Am I right?
That doesn't sound familiar, but we did talk about this guy.
Okay, yeah. And he was in Chicano Christ. He's in Metro Shifter. He's in a bunch of bands. And it turns out he was in a band called Thingy, who I haven't thought about in 20 years. And I saw that name and I was like, holy shit, man. I used to love that record. And it all came back to me. So if you guys have never heard of Thingy also features some guy named Rob Crow, who's one of those guys who's been in 38,000 other like fairly famous bands. So this was just a band of famous people that you've not really heard of. but yeah, Thingy was like this weird indie pop band for people who don't like indie pop. And they had they've had a couple records, but they had the record I really liked was called To the Innocent. And they have a song on there called Ketchup Sandwich. And if you've never heard this song, I want everybody to just stop this podcast and go listen to Ketchup Sandwich, because as soon as this memory was evoked in my brain again, I listened to that song like 8 times last week because I think it's a fucking amazing, like, catchy song. Again, it's a catchy song for people who don't like indie pop music. And that whole record's great. I'm not going to vouch for the rest of their music, but check out Thingy if you haven't. And that's kind of my research for Candle. I think it's very weird that these guys went on to other bands and they all seemed to begin at 1993 and end around 1998. And then they were all like, let's go get real jobs, I guess. Like, I don't, I mean, maybe Scott has more info, but it seems like these guys were just like in and out of music. And that's all I know about them.
Oh, okay. So the one guy who's easy to research sort of is the Grant Rennero or Rennero. Yeah. He ran the label and he eventually went into doing some kind of video production stuff. And now he's got like cool websites because he works for an ad agency and does videos and many, many movies and all kinds of stuff. I didn't really watch any of it. I don't know if it's any good, but he's a bona fide citizen these days with a real, real career. So he's kind of easy to find. And he's also been interviewed a lot because he's done he did a lot of stuff back then. So, you know, these guys are from San Diego. Mostly, I mean, they're from, I forget what city you said, but they're
Del Mar.
They're based in San Diego.
Yeah.
Like a lot of bands. So, Mike, do you know anything about the San Diego scene, like the 90s San Diego scene?
I just know, I think Swing Kids was from there too, but that's about it. And fucking Struggle was from there, right?
Yeah, it's basically the same
kids. And Downcast was from San Diego too, I believe.
Yeah, so there's a pretty good doc on Amazon about the San Diego scene. It's like known for two things. Which is like chaotic, noisy guitars and all the bands going goth. not all of them, but like a lot of bands for some reason tend to try to go goth at some point. But yeah, like they had a band called Crash Worship who were crazy. The John Reese, the Rocket from the Crypt guy, has done a ton of bands. So it's a really good documentary because it's a really weird scene. of all like noisy, barely listenable rock, mathy, you know, like detuned. It all sounds kind of like unwound Sonic Youth influence, kind of ugly. And some of them are really good. Like John Reese is actually a really good musician. So the bands that he's in tend to wrangle that in and make it cool. You know, like it has a shape. Because you could just make noise and that's stupid. But if you can kind of make a shape out of the noise, that's music. And so his is kind of musical and some of them aren't. But that they're it's like super influential on a lot of other stuff. But like all the bands from that scene are the ones that people name from the 90s if they want to sound cool. Because they're one step removed from just naming Ebullition bands. Like you could just name Ebullition bands, or you could say, no, I listen to like Heroin. I listen to, you know, Moss Icon and stuff like that. And now, you're swinging dick now, man. You crazy. But yeah, everybody that Candle went on to form, those bands are all pretty cool too. Like Spanacorzo is actually pretty good, noisy, screamy, mathy rock or whatever. Antioch Arrow definitely went goth. They're on the record as having gone goth. Like they say, we went goth. And actually the Grant Renero is now in a band called Stewardess, who he just says it's goth. And like I was reading an interview and they're like, so what's it like being a goth band in San Diego? He's like, you know, the ocean and the desert makes people emotional. So this is the city for goth. He doesn't really hide it. They just do it. And Klikitatikatawi, I can't really put my finger on why they're influential. I mean, they are. Like you hear their name all the time for things, but I don't know what they led to. I don't know what they directly led to. That it's a whole scene where there's a lot of bands who will put out a lot of stuff, and most of it I don't like. But one song on every record I will really like. Like there'll be at least one or two songs on every record that's awesome. I'm like, man, I'll pull out Drive Like I'll go get my Drive Like Jehu CD because I want to hear Luau. I want to hear that song. I love that song. Like put it on and then take the CD back out when I'm done. So. That's pretty much all of Gravity Records. Gravity Records is the label that kind of did a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
I tried my best as a kid to keep up with that scene. It's really hard to do when you're young. I owned a lot of records by these guys. I owned a couple Spanacorzo records. I had the Swing Kids one, but, you know, this was tough to be into as a metal kid because I wanted some structure. And these kids, these guys were not all that much about structure. Not a lot of dirt on this band, though. I didn't find anything, you know.
But yeah, I mean, that kind of leads into the record labels. Wrench Records was pre-Gravity, and this was kind of, I guess, for a few years from 93 to 98. If you were a band from San Diego and you made this type of music, you probably had a record on there, as they put out most of the Spanacorzo stuff. They didn't put out that split. Boilermaker, Evergreen, Antioch Arrow. And the Calabash Case, which I don't think I've ever heard of, Shortwave Channel. Yeah. But yeah, so that's pretty much their label. Again, it kind of just disappeared in 98. Mm-hmm. And it's strange because when I pre-Hatebreed, I grew up in Connecticut, if you guys don't know. And pre-Hatebreed, it seemed like most bands, like 80% of bands in Connecticut, were really into Burn. And they kind of like, you know, they did their version of Burn in their own way. And it seemed like, you know, that was the seed for every band was Burn. And it's, but you know, and in the end, like the bands there sounded, you know, somewhat different. And it was all kind of just like hardcore music. I can't imagine like being from San Diego and like, this was your scene. Like it's so jarring compared to like, like a lot of the stuff that was going on in the rest of the country. So it just shows how like kind of, insular everything was before the internet, how you could just be stuck in a scene of very screamy, mathy kind of screamo or just straight up emo.
Albany in the 90s was well known for Into Another t-shirts. Yeah. Everyone here had Into Another long sleeves. Mike, how many Albany bands sounded like Into Another?
Yeah, none. I mean, I think you could say the End of Line was kind of trying to sing like Richie, but I don't think so. It was the same thing in Connecticut, though. And Into Another was like gods there. That was the second show I ever went to was Into Another. And it stood as like the most packed show I've ever been to for a really long time up until like the real rise of Earth Crisis and stuff like that. But Into Another was definitely a shirt, and I never understood it. I mean, we talked about this on Holesfield, but I never understood it. I think later on there was a couple bands that tried to sound like Into Another, but at the height of the Into Another t-shirt era, there weren't any bands that sounded like Into Another.
They weren't even trying.
No.
especially at that point, I think Into Another, that's probably when like Seamless was out or something. So they sound like, they sound like Blind Melon. On, like they barely sound like hardcore by then. And everyone was like so into them. And I remember buying that record. I was like, what is this? Like, you know, you can hear it. Like you can definitely hear the hardcore influence of it, man. And the pictures of them, they look like Urge Overkill or something like that in the photo shoots. There's actually an interview on 31G because they're sort of tied in.
Yeah,
with the 31G and Grant, like he sort of talks about this label and how it got started, and so this record we're gonna review was a class project for college. Like the reason he even put this out and even started a label was that, you know, he had some sort of music production class or something that he wanted to do something for.
Okay,
and then this became his big obsession. Like this, you know, this is what happens when you're young. The thing that you start has a little success and then it eats you and it. And he spent all of his pizza delivery money putting out these records. And then he managed to get in with Cargo, who was like a big distribution. You know, like, I don't know if they were contemporary with Caroline or something like that, but it was kind of like that, where you could get weird stuff distributed on Cargo, and even though it was a big thing or whatever. And that was it. Like they got into this. They struck gold, but they struck gold at the time. And every young person's life eventually hits a wall where all your friends start having babies or something, and they can't be in bands anymore. And since they were all just his buddies, like the label just fizzled. He's like, oh, nobody wants to be a band anymore. And we just got distribution through Cargo. So he just left the label to the other two guys and walked. And, you know, I don't really know exactly what happened after that, but I don't know anything off this label other than Span of Corzo. And I only know Span of Corzo from the Swing Kids split, which is not on Wrenched. So,
Yeah, I mean, the only other band I was super familiar with by like hearing them on samplers and stuff was Boilermaker.
Yeah.
But I guess that actually answers some questions, because I was going to be kind of harsh on this review, but the fact that this was kind of a project, it makes a lot more sense now. But the actual record. The personal part, I have, you know, as you probably know, I don't really have any kind of memories of this band. But when I was flipping through stuff to buy, this was cheap. And just by the cover, I knew what it was. I knew what this is all about. This was going to be prime 90s emo. I knew it. And I was like, finally, we can talk about some real emo to get some feelings off my chest, because I was always like, I never liked emo when I was a kid.
Yeah,
I thought it was wimpy. I thought it was terrible. Listening now, it doesn't sound as wimpy as I remember it. It's like regular hardcore always never sounds as heavy as I remember it, and emo never sounds as wimpy. But it was something I hated, but I was always very curious about, because I just could not fathom why anybody would want to be like that. Like, would want to be wimpy. Like, why would you want to start a band and kind of just be like, I'm shy and like, I have emotions. Like, it just seemed like so strange to me, because I came from a completely different world than like anybody who would make music that sounded like this and that acted like this and dressed like this. So it's always been like a kind of like a nut I wanted to crack. And you know, now I'm older and I can appreciate music for what it is. I still think behind Hare Krishna, emo, that the original emo, not what, you know, the My Chemical Romance shit, but the original stuff, I think it was still the biggest cosplay when it came to hardcore of my generation, where I was just kind of like, I don't know, like everything about it was just, you had a, Even Krishna Core was a lot less structured than emo was. Yeah. There's a lot of tropes of emo that you had to perform in order to be emo. And so it always interested me, and I'm glad we could do like kind of like an untouched, like Fresh Snow version of an emo record no one fucking knows about. So no one can have any preconceived notions of this record unless you are a real old head that loved the San Diego music, because I think this band is fairly obscure.
I was kind of the same way, but less knowledgeable about what I wasn't liking. So I was like a fat Hessian warrior. You know, I was definitely like very, like, you know, I wasn't, but I was trying to be like an alpha dog all the time, you know, when I was like a young kid trying to be a funny, like, you know, knucklehead, and wasn't into being emotional. And by then I had retired my ET record, so I wasn't crying about music by then. So all I knew was my friend Jason, who I talked about, the Monster X guy I talked about him last episode. He just was in class. He's like, yeah, there's this new kind of hardcore. It's called, it wasn't new. I'm not that old. Emo had been around for I don't know how long, because yeah, there's this new kind of hardcore out there. It's called like emotional hardcore, and it's they call it emo, and everyone just falls down and crying. They just fall down the stage crying, and I was like, that sucks. That was it. That was like my thought, and then I didn't know anything about it. I hadn't heard anything. I'd never listened to Split Lip or anything that was, you know, in the news back then as being crybaby rock music. All I knew was that emo sounded really wimpy, same as you, without having heard any of it. And it wasn't until my friend Davin that I talked about in another episode, the guy who clued me in to like Fugazi and Embrace. He gave me an Embrace record. He goes, oh, this is pretty emo. You might not like it then. And I was like, well, this is awesome. This sounds cool. Like, this is fine. And there is emo that is, I think, what we're thinking of. There's plenty of emo out there that was kind of like whiny. You know, we talked about that too in a different episode, but there was definitely some whiny, you know, some kind of crybaby stuff that I still would think is kind of silly. It's a little too performative. How do you get up on stage and start crying? Unless you have a problem, unless you have a button in your body somewhere and you have a problem that you can create that situation. How do you get up on stage and start, you know, melting down or whatever? So I was against that when I was a kid until I got into screamo, and I didn't know it was screamo. I didn't know it was related to emo. I thought it just sounded kind of like harder black metal or something to me. So I was like, this is sick. So I knew some of these bands. I had nothing. I've never heard of Candle. I never heard of this before in my life. I've never heard this record. I definitely heard of Span of Corzo, Antioch Arrow, Click Attack, Atawi. But you know, back then I didn't have a lot of zines and stuff, so I didn't know anything about these bands. I didn't know they're connected. It's actually kind of weird. Even like later on, I'm like, oh geez, they're all like, they'll know each other. They're all from the same neighborhood. All the noisy weird bands are from the same fucking place, and we're doing the same things and have the same members. You know, I didn't have the budget to buy everything. So I wasn't going to be collecting all these records, and I didn't have a lot of, I was really bad about mail order. I was like scared to order things through the mail because I didn't have a checking account. I was like a broke kid. Did you order records when you were young?
No, God, no. I mean, I think I just started ordering records like 3 years ago.
Just now, because I can use PayPal.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I've always had that stigma from not doing it as a kid where I was just like, no, I got to buy records in real life. Like, I don't know. I've just always been like that.
Yeah, I had to buy them at stores, and there was only a couple stores in Albany that were even doing that back then. So, you know, I had the Swing Kids record with Span of Corzo. I had one of the Antioch Arrow records. I think I had the later one when they went goth. And then, you know, luckily, Click Attack Tally only had the one album. So I got those motherfuckers by the ball. So I got them all set. I got that record, and I'm clear. But I have other than that, I have no personal connection to the record we're about to talk to.
So the Discog says this record has three versions. And I am here to tell you, I have an undocumented version of this record. The version I have is not on Discogs because they have a black cover and a red cover, and then they have a green vinyl version. The cover I have is reddish; it's almost maroon, and it's not the cover that was scanned into. It's not scanned in Discogs. I mean, it's the same picture, but it's not the same color. It's not the same shade, and the actual label on in the inside of the record is different, and. Also, all these versions that were scanned come with this long strip of paper that is either handwritten cursive or like handwritten and then copied cursive. And mine did not come with that at all either. So I have, you know, I might have the only copy of this Candle record. This might be the only version on earth. I might have the master copy. It's not a test press or anything, but it's definitely not a version. But outside of that, it's pretty simple. It's, you know, two sides, the front and back. The front cover, it says Candle on the bottom in a, you know, font that came with your computer. And it's a picture of like a black and white photo of a shed and some branches. And you're like, oh, okay, I know what this is. This is going to be some emo music. The back is a reverse color kind of X-ray type of filter photo of a guy playing a guitar. You just see his hands in the guitar. Inside is blank except for it has a little thing, Wrenched Records, hand-drawn little advertisement for this record and Antioch Arrow, Candle, and then Evergreen. Which is weird because these are the first three records they put out, but somehow the Boilermaker records have an earlier date on them. So they went back in time to put out those Boilermaker records, I guess. And then there's a little heavier cardstock, orange and black piece of paper that has, you know, tells you who's in the band. Has little thank yous, and then it has what I think is a poem, because this is not the lyrics to the song. And I, you know, again, like I said, there's a lot of tropes in emo, and I think one of the tropes is being shy, and you don't want the bullies to read your lyrics, your very personal lyrics. So I get not including the lyrics, but then like Why are you including a poem, man, or whatever the fuck this is? I don't know what this is. I try to read it, but I'm not into the handwriting.
It's a bad font.
And it's just like, it's hard to read. And it says all, like, it says Silver, and that's the name of one of the songs. So maybe it's like, I don't know what this is, but I don't think it's the lyrics. And it's just kind of a waste of paper. But as far as the cover goes, it is, you know, if you were from that time period, you know what this is. So as far as that goes, they hit the mark. Also, the actual record label has some gears on it, some old timey gears. And some other fucking old-timey machine on the B-side. And that was probably pretty emo back in 1994, but right now it's pretty steampunk. So this might be confused as a steampunk record in the 21st century, but this is a tried-and-true emo cover.
The cover itself really had me thinking of something I couldn't place, and I was like really sitting... I kept thinking that of metal albums, and I kept thinking of Trouble, and it's not any Trouble record. I don't know. I just was like, is there a Trouble record I just can't find in Google Images for whatever reason? That no, it's not. It's Bleach. It's Nirvana's Bleach. It's the same. Okay. It's like the same layout as Nirvana's Bleach. The actual Nirvana record has a solarized, like, inverted image, and the back of this record has the same one. And I think this might be after Bleach. So these guys might have had little bleach in their veins when they decided to put this together. So the rest of the layout, I don't think this layout is all that embarrassing or anything like that. It looks just like how you'd expect if you're from the era. You know what this is. But pardon a few minutes of guitar chat for the boys. Anybody wants to talk about guitars? The back cover has he's playing an SG or an SG in quotes. And I thought he was playing an SGX. And I own an SG90, which is the precursor to the SGX. Mike, you would know it as the secret weapon. You made a web page for it when we were in Eviction. There was a secret button you could click on the page that just took you to thousands of pictures of my guitar. It said secret weapon on it. So that's a legendary instrument right there. And then our friend Hans, who was in End of a Year with an SGX, his is pink, and I want it. And I've always wanted it. I think it's dying in his hands. I think it's just like rotting away as he owns it. Because, you know, the wood just goes bad sometimes if you don't do certain things. So he has that. The problem is everything I just said, everything I just talked about, doesn't matter. Because that's not what this guitar is. It looked just like one. I was like, oh, man, I got that guitar. It's not. They have this is a very, very valuable Les Paul Jr. that he's playing, which is also weird because it has a P90 pickup. So guitar guys, hit me up and let's talk about that P90 and how that happened. But yeah, I was wrong. Oh, totally wrong. That's like a $5,000 guitar this guy's playing. I don't own a $5,000 guitar.
I mean, it kind of makes sense if how they're putting out all these fucking records as kids. Put out a lot of records pocket. In succession. Yeah, out of pocket. Including this one, which is two fucking tracks, clocking in under 6 minutes. You guys know how much I hate this stuff. And so I'm a little less harsh on it now that Scott said it was kind of a school project. Yeah. And I'm assuming they kind of threw this band together. I don't know the history of this band, but I'm assuming they probably did play a lot of shows in the short time they were together. Mm-hmm. And so that's a little more excusable, because putting out a two-song 7-inch and being kind of an unknown band is real ballsy. So I'll excuse it a little. But the first track on side A is called Green Grass. The Nirvana thing kind of makes sense, because this is a little mid-tempo and it was getting a little kind of played a little differently Sonic Youth from it. And I also throw Nirvana in there. So I think these guys, at least the guitarist, was probably a fan of the Seattle sound back then. Mm-hmm. So that's safe to say. So not super, it's emo, you know, you could tell this was probably emo just by kind of the vocals, but off the bat, you're not being bombarded by sadness yet. This is kind of just like a mid-tempo, not grunge, but like alt-rock, early alt-rock sound. The vocals are very buried into the the mix. This guy is very shy. He's very shy. He doesn't want anybody to hear his delicate vocals. And I was immediately upset when I looked at the liner notes and found out that this guy is not also the guitarist. This is a separate singer.
Right.
Exactly. This guy is he's not putting in a lot of work, man. Like you can't be in a band and be this shy, and I don't know. Because it's like, it's not only are the vocals buried, but you can tell he's far away from the mic too, and it's just kind of like, I get it, man. You can do this on stage, this whole act, but like in the studio, yeah. You gotta nut up or shut up, man. You can't just be doing this. But you know, it's not like he has an exceptional voice. You're not just like, oh, I gotta hear what this guy's croaky fucking trying to sing voices, because it's not good. What is good though is that the as we said, these guys are from San Diego, and he has that California accent that they make fun of on Saturday Night Live in the Californian sketch. When they hit the you know, the quote unquote chorus, when he says green grass, he says green grass. And it's just like, as a person from the Northeast, that's pretty funny that way they say stuff like that. Like everybody talks like a surfer, and you could completely tell this. So there's a lot. Technically, the song is kind of sloppy, I guess, not like sloppily played, but there's like, I think I didn't write it down, but I think before they go into the green grass part, the song just kind of stops and starts real quick. Like, it's just like, oh, we don't know how to get into this part. Let's just do it. And they just like, you know, switch over to green grass mode. And then there's a part sort of in the, to like 2/3 through, where the song stops to make it dramatic. Yeah. Like the guitar rings out and he whispers a few words. I can't hear what it says. And then it's pop, 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 pop. You hear the drums. And then they go right back in the part they were playing before the song stopped. And it's just like, why'd you fucking stop the song, man? What's going on? Like, you, there's no like crescendo here. You're just going, like, you're just, yeah. That's stupid. That's a dumb move. But again, like I said, school project. And then the song just kind of ends. Like, they had no idea what to do, but I'm not well versed in emo. I have a feeling that might be an emo thing, to just be like, oh, we're so tired. We have expended all of our emotion. We just do not know how to end a song. So it just ends. So I'll give them that. With that said, the better of the two tracks. I think the song is kind of catchy, you know, with all its shortcomings. I think it's a listenable song. You might want to listen to this one.
A lot of things are swirling together, like they're piecing together in my brain, like Rain Man, like putting math together in the casino. It's all coming to me now, because I hadn't even though I said the thing before about the project and the Nirvana thing, I hadn't really put any of that together in my brain when I was listening to this. And so the bass always introduces the song. So if this is his class, he's probably showing the band how to play the song, even on the record. He's probably looking at him and like showing him and playing the bass so they can figure out how the song goes. And the bass intro is actually kind of, I think he knows how to play. Like, this is a pretty neat bass intro. But it is just, you know, like you said, it is also kind of like dreary, you know, it's got that dreary grungy kind of like a melody or whatever to it. So it is kind of like rainy day sounding, I don't know, indie rock stuff or whatever. I don't know if the bassist maintains that melody through the song. I think it just goes away because the mix gets pretty crowded pretty quick once everybody joins in. The singer, the shy guy singer, I mean, there's a couple things I would really want to double down on that Mike talked about. The singer, he gets to the chorus, and the chorus is actually pretty catchy. I can't remember off the top of my head what he says or anything.
Green grass.
Yeah. Well, before that, like, there's kind of like a chorusy part that's a little bit more. Hard hitting, and he gets that part, and then he walks away from the mic. He fucking walks away for sure and goes to like another place, and he's still hemorrhaging out words. He's got a lot of gardening metaphors he's got to get out that are in these lyrics, and he keeps doing them, but he's wandered off. He's not near the mic for at least a minute of the song. And the breakdown, the two minute mark, that when the song falls apart for a second, they do a shockingly bad job of coming back together. Like, no two band members are playing the same buildup the same way. They're just, it's just completely falls apart, and they just, oh shit, and they all start playing this all different. It's just a free for all, but amazingly they all come back together at exactly, they hit their mark. So these guys are like the Beethovens of fucking up. They land from chaos. So I don't know, you know, if we zoom out from this a little bit, like, I would say this version of emo is, or what, if they even called this band emo at the time, I'm not sure if they would have copped to that, but this is a little lost on me, because this is like these guys probably listen to Merge Records bands like Superchunk, Archers of Loaf, that kind of stuff, I didn't. There's nothing. Nothing in there that I would have ever listened to. I don't really like. We tried. We all holes filled a couple of those bands.
Yeah.
I can never get my hands around it because I don't like out of tune guitarists. I don't like bullshit singing. And you know, chances are the song ends that way because they've never had to finish a song before. They're supposed to fall down crying. They're not really expected to write a full, to perform a full song even once.
I'll say this is definitely more of the kind of the vision of emo, 90s emo I have, where I'm just like, this is the kind of shitty emo that I didn't like, is this this sound and wimpier stuff than this. But
he does hit a technical necessity that I don't know how to describe. It's on records I like. I think even Ink and Dagger does it. There's a part where I think a girl sings along with him. Mm-hmm. On Ink and Dagger, he does the really emo like vocal bend thing. Yeah. This guy does it a lot. So there was some notes being passed around among emo bands.
Yeah. So side B, the second track is called Silver. Is also kind of mid-tempo in the same tempo as the last one, but this is a little more Sunny Day Real Estate, that type of, which again could be just mistaken as alt rock, but this has a little more traditional 90s emo song, like around the Mineral, the Sunny Day, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Not as good, but you know, it has more of the traditional sound that you're used to. At first it sounds like the singer has a game plan in this one. He's you know, he's doing like the music's playing with like a riff, you know, there's an accent on the riff, and then he does the lyrics, and there's an accent, he does the lyrics, and it's like, you know, he has a cadence going, and then by halfway through it just sounds like he's fucking riffing, man. It just sounds like he's he ran out of lyrics in that those first minute, and he's like, oh, I guess I just gotta go off the dome for the rest of this song, because that's what it sounds like. And I don't know if it was, but I'll get into it. But the song also has a stop part. This stop part, paused for a dramatic effect, does capture an actual mistake. I know what it sounds like when a drummer drops a drumstick and picks it up real quick to keep going. And this drummer definitely dropped his drumstick at the stop part. You can tell he dropped it. It's a college class. Probably didn't have a lot of time in that recording studio, but he definitely dropped his drumstick. And speaking of those lyrics, there's a part which if it's not on the dome, they should have fired this guy. I don't care if they were only a band for a year, but there's some lyrics where he says, "That's the way I feel. It feels." I should say how he says it. He says, "That's the way I feel. It feels real. It's just the way I feel. Yeah, it's real." And if those are your lyrics, and that's and this is how you sing 30 feet away from the microphone, I don't know, man. What guy is this? What did he go on to? Was he in another band, or is this the guy who just didn't do anything?
Click Attack Atawi. This is Matt Goldsby.
Well, he must have got better then. Good for him. Good for him. He stepped up to the microphone. He dropped this emo shit. I thought Matt was a drummer, but yeah. So it's good. He gets better then. He didn't retire forever. He's a little better in Click Attack. But yeah, and this again, if this was a thing, like if it was really a college project and they made this band in like a weekend and recorded in a weekend or something, then fine. This is all fine. And I think if this is really like a weekend or even a month long project, that first song is great. But I think the second song is pretty weak.
Yeah, the first song had kind of like almost like a hypnotic drone kind of shimmering thing going on through it. And it had a chorus. That's always great. Mm-hmm. Kind of kept me involved, but this song is the death spiral. It's like it's laid back rock, you know, it's weak meandering vocals, and the guitars are utterly out of tune, like just fully out of tune. And you know, Sunny Day, I'd say I was thinking Sunny Day too, just because it probably sounds almost exactly like maybe like the third track or something like that on the album. Everybody likes at least one or two Sunny Day songs, but I quickly run out after the one or two songs. I'm not a huge fan after that. And, you know, I want to be cool about this because I know this isn't my lane. So I'm just not going to come in, not just walk into this room and shit on your laid back indie rock. There's room for us both in the world. We gave a lot of that stuff a shot, and people like love this sound. They love this kind of, you know, loose, abstract, I don't know, Sonic Youth influence stuff. I just don't really, it doesn't do much for me. I'm like a riff person from too much thrash metal when I was a kid. And you know, I go to shows where guys scream like a toddler for 45 minutes on purpose. Like that's the music that I listen to is also imbecile music. We all listen to imbecile music. So I don't have the high ground or anything like that. This isn't really for me, but I've recorded some product where the final product comes out and the intonation on the guitars is not fantastic. So I understand that happens once in a while and I want to be cool about it. But this guitar is 100% not in tune. It's like a whole step out of tune. It's 100% solvable problem. You heard it. You know it was happening when you're there. None of your notes were in tune. So I don't have any obligation to be nice to you anymore. I don't have any. You were not nice to me, and I don't have to be nice to you. This song has a cool beat. I don't think that it really counts as punk or hardcore particularly. I think this just sounds like indie rock, even under the sense field law of 90s misunderstandings. You know, like just because you're buddies with hardcore guys or whatever. This is just noisy indie. It doesn't hit any of the other very narrow targets required for me to peer any deeper and find the silver lining in your music. It's not, this is emo only, not emo core. I don't know what else you would call this, but I really do not like this song. I've really lost hope.
Well, there you go. It's unanimous. First song, okay. Second song, not so much. As far as my rating system goes, I either throw the record in the trash, buy it from the bargain bin, buy it for full price, or buy it for collector's prices. I'm not gonna say throw this in the trash because I think it's cool to listen to this shit because it's gone. No one's making this music anymore, and if they are making it anymore, it's disingenuous. They're making it because they bought this record and they were like, we should make something like this, and then it's even more of kind of a cosplay than it was originally. So it just doesn't exist anymore. But I also don't think I'm going to throw it in the trash just from an investor's perspective, which is for some reason, this emo shit, people love it. I think it's rare. Like I said, it was made for a few years and then it stopped, and every record is rare. There's very few emo records, outside of Sunny Day Real Estate that are just all over the place that you can buy at any time. I paid $4 for this, which is kind of that's kind of my price point where, anything more, it has to be something that's going to be guaranteed a good episode. I can't just blindly buy something for $5. And this is cheap. I think if you actually do want this record, I think you are going to have to pay collector's prices because it's at least full price. But I'm saying if you spot this in a bargain bin, give it a shot. If you just want to know what it sounds like just a shitty average 90s emo. But I can't recommend it. Outside of that, maybe listen to the first song on YouTube, but that's the best review I'm giving.
Yeah. So I just spent a good few minutes shitting on this class project hard, probably the hardest we've shit on something so far. But I do think it's worth noting that this record has some atmosphere. It does really have kind of like a thing. It sounds, especially the first song, it's like the way that they play guitars or something. It's got kind of like a backdrop to it. And that's cool. You know, I like that stuff. We have played with and pretended to be friends with bands whose entire very heartfelt, very painstaking discographies were way worse than this record. Guys who were legit preoccupied around the clock with bands who utterly sucked from like soup to nuts were bad. We're friends with bad bands. We know bad bands. I don't think you can say that about Candle. I don't think Candle's like a totally bad band, especially if this is like thrown together. Like over a weekend, the whole band, you know, or they were kind of new or young or whatever.
Their short resume speaks for itself. Everything else they did after this is fine. It's fine to great. So this is, you know, this isn't like, it's not like they just grew up and sucked forever. This is just a kind of a one-off thing.
On the other hand, I've given twos and threes to better records than this. that's the ceiling. You can't get above a two. And I'm at kind of an impasse. I want to say this is a one. A 1 out of 5, because it's very far afield of anything that I like. But there exists a person out there, like a a broken person out there who likes music like this, and this is a 5 for you. So I'm going to give this a 1.5 deep wound cable knit sweaters out of 5. And if you're someone who listens to, like, I don't know, Sebado or something, maybe this is your kill 'em all. Maybe this is full price for you.
There you go. Check it out. If you're kind of a wimp, if you grew up a wimp and there was no one stopping you from being a wimp, and you just ran around high school just being shy and getting stuffed in lockers and not doing anything about it, you might want to check this out. But until then, we'll be back next week, probably with something a little harder than this, probably, I would assume. So until then, you can check us out on YouTube for 7-Inch Club, on Instagram for 7-Inch Club. If you want to write in and give us a suggestion for 7-Inch Club at Gmail, all that good stuff. Go chat away on our Instagram. Do all that stuff. Until then, we'll talk to you later.
And tune your fucking guitar. Tune it. Tuners are like $9 now. Take care of it.